This week on the BOAG World Show, we talk about design iteration, achieving design clarity, and going from idea to application. This week's show is sponsored by Full Story and Teacup Analytics. Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, a podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul BOAG and joining me on this week's show is, well, nobody really. It's all gone a bit horribly wrong. So, as you will know from last week's show, Marcus is away on holiday at the moment, which is very nice for him. His 28th holiday of the year, which you've got to respect, really. For somebody who says they work really hard. But anyway, so I was supposed to be joined by Andy Clark on this week's show. But we had a little bit of confusion over time zones, bless him. I mean, he is in Australia now and he's adopted that laid back Australian lifestyle. And so really just couldn't be bothered to turn up, I think is the main thing. Apparently got confused over British summertime. But, you know, I'm not sure I believe him. But anyway, so it leaves just me, which is interesting because I have not done a podcast by myself since about episode 6. So that's what, 6 years ago? More than 10 years ago. Flip me. God, I feel so old. So I don't know how this is going to work. We'll just have to kind of see. It doesn't help that I'm also dying of hay fever. I've never had hay fever like I've got it this year. It's like, it's the curse of being British. We spend our whole lives complaining about the rain and the weather. And then when the sun comes out, we immediately get hay fever and burn ourselves horribly. So there is really no pleasing us. But there you go. So we've got some great stuff lined up on this show. We've got 3 talks, so don't worry, you don't have to listen to me talk at you for an hour. I imagine it's probably going to be a bit of a shorter show this week because it is just me. But we've got 3 talks coming up. You will actually get to hear Marcus because Marcus is on this week's show as he's doing a talk, which is kind of weird, but it's great because I get to pick it apart afterwards, which is always a nice feeling. We've also got a couple of other brilliant talks lined up as well. So there's lots to look forward to in this show. So as it's just you and me this week, I think we can dispense with the normal waffle and jump straight into our first talk, which is from Frida. And she is a front-end designer developer for a small web agency called Red Onion, based just outside of Stockholm, Sweden. Always amuses me. Take a random object, add a colour, and you've got the name of a web design agency. Red Onion. Love it. For 6 years, she's been helping people realize their app visions of, you know, how to actually build an app and to get it up and running. And they've built apps that calculate environmental impact, map personality profiles, as well as more business orientated and kind of intranet, social intranet type apps as well. So a big range of different work that she's worked on. But what she's going to talk to us about today is this idea of going from idea to application. How do you get from, oh, I've got an idea for an app, to actually making that app happen? So, over to Frida.
Hi, I'm Frida Nyvall. I'm a front-end designer developer from Sweden. Today I'm going to talk about the journey from idea to application. Apart from mobile apps, I also include websites or platforms offering services like Facebook, Etsy, and Airbnb in the app concept. Obviously, those examples are huge, but you get the idea. Also, this is aimed at normal people and smaller businesses. The process is of course a lot different if you're backed by billions, say if you're a super entrepreneur or represent a very large corporation. So, often when struggling with some task or trying to solve a problem, haven't we all sometimes just said to ourselves, there should be an app for this, I wish there was an app for this, or I had the idea for an app just like this years ago, but why didn't I make it happen? Don't feel disheartened. Instead, congratulate yourself on completing the first step on your journey from idea to application, actually coming up with a smashing idea. But before you take that leap of joy, make sure you're not the only one thinking the idea is great. do some research and vet it with people you trust, preferably from the app's future target group. If all are thumbs up, your next step is explaining your idea to even more people. The next step on your journey might prove a little bit more challenging. Transferring your great idea from your mind into a document is hard work, and some would even say outright boring. Even so, the rewards for doing your homework will outweigh those long hours you spent drawing arrows in PowerPoint and fighting formatting in Word. A detailed and well-written project description will help convince investors, developers, and other potential partners that your ideas are indeed as great and outstanding as you promised, you know, in your fantastic elevator pitch last night. It will also help keep the project scope clearly defined, making the project easier to assess. A useful tip is to be sure to drill down to details and be as specific as possible. Take some time and think about what you want the core functionalities to be, which functions are nice to have, and which can be added in the next version. Focus on the essential features in the first version. The nice-to-haves can come in later. This will help reduce the initial investment and hopefully leave some extra cash to invest in promoting the product. A warning, however, do not, and I repeat, do not underestimate how boring this work can be. In fact, it is so boring that a lot of people tend to rush or skip doing this step completely, which I think is a big mistake. So, this is what happens. Instead of asking for a quote on a clearly outlined and defined project, they ask for a quote on a link, a URL. They go, "I'd like a quote on building a copy of Airbnb. Now I don't have any project description, and I don't need that, because you can just go to the site, airbnb.com, and see for yourself. I want it to be just like that. All of it. Okay?" Then, they get the quote, which probably also comes with a heart attack, because I've never heard anything from them again. So, sitting down, taking time to go through the details of your idea will not only lead to a better app. As a bonus, properly defining the project will also help getting more accurate time and price estimates. The next step is perhaps where the most projects lay down and die. It's like a fork in the road with a sign saying, "Do you have funding? Do you need funding? Are you broke but determined? Don't worry, all roads lead to Rome, but some will take just a little bit longer." If you have funding for a project, lucky you, your next destination is to find someone to make it happen. If you need funding, your next stop is to start reaching out to potential investors. If you've done your homework and written a kick-ass project specification, that will be very much in your favor. There are various strategies for attracting investments, ranging from selling homemade lemonade, starting a Kickstarter campaign, calling your rich uncle, applying for grant money, or doing social media campaigns to get attention. And, of course, contacting known investors and organizations. Well, yeah, the part about lemonade was intended as a joke, but truth is, getting investments is hard, and you might need to get a little bit creative to get at least enough funds to get started. Just remember that a common practice when you have some funds, but maybe not enough to see the project through from start to finish, is to give equity in the project to people whose services you need but can't fully compensate. In general, the more time and work you're asking your partners to invest, the higher risk they are taking. Risk, in turn, has to be compensated. If you're broke but determined, there's always the option to do it yourself. How difficult it'll be or how long it'll take, naturally, will depend on your familiarity and existing experience with the field or topic, as well as how much time you're willing to dedicate. At university, I once had a professor who, when asked to explain an assignment, came up with the following encouraging quote delivered in a deep American accent. "It's easy. Anyone can do it. Students can do it. You can do it." This gave me no clue on how to solve the assignment, but at least it taught me that there is a difference in knowing something and being able to pass it on to others. So, to sum up, for most people, it will generally take less time to find someone to hire to do the job, even if your budget is really small, compared to how long it will take learning all the skills to be able to create an app of similar standards yourself. And that brings us to the next step. How to best find someone to make it happen. Finding the right partner for a project that is very close to heart isn't always easy. Most begin by asking acquaintances and relatives, posting requests and ads on social networks and job boards. A common mistake many people make when seeking help is the way they describe their needs in relation to the project. If the project is described as revolutionary, requiring expert knowledge from over a dozen areas of expertise, it doesn't make sense to describe the process of building it as fairly simple. A lot of people do this in hope of making the project work cheaper. But all it does is scare away potential partners because it gives the impression they don't value the work that has to be put in. Another challenge is to estimate the time and price suggestions from potential partners. It's often easy to become just a little bit too hopeful when it comes to how long it will take and how much it'll cost. My best tip to avoid disappointment is to examine existing competitors or companies with similar services or products. What does their turnover look like? How many employees do they have? How is the organization distributed in terms of, for example, finance, marketing, development? Then try to position your idea and project based on these facts. It will help you get a general idea of the resources needed to make your idea come to life. If it isn't possible to procure as much resources as your competitors, consider various other ways to differentiate the product. So, after successfully finding a partner, in an ideal world, you'd be living happily ever after, producing the most amazing app ever. However, there are a few pitfalls that could put an ugly end to that rosy future. First up is recognizing that design is more than just pretty pixels. It's not just putting something together that you think looks nice. It's about creating a product that solves problems and fulfills user needs, and at the same time invokes the desired feelings and actions you want people to take. In most cases, this means make people feel good about giving you money for making their lives easier by using the app. Remember, just because your favorite color is black, it might not be the color that works best for the app. Second is realizing the importance of user experience and the impact it has on the app. In most cases, you're not creating an app to be used by just a few people in a certain demographic, like white, middle-aged males with higher than average income, no disabilities, using the latest iPhone with a high-speed internet connection. The average user might actually not be you. So make sure to acknowledge who they are and give them a good experience using your app. And finally, don't be afraid to ask for help. Just because it's your idea and vision, you don't have to know the solution to every problem. Your team can help you, but only if you let them in on what the problem is. So don't make more work for yourself by presuming you're the only one who can solve it. For example, trust your designer to decide with Comic Sans, as a general typeface is a good idea for inspiring the feelings of creative and modern professionality you've been pitching. In short, respect the design, respect the user, and in the role of project owner, delegate, don't try to micromanage. And all will be well. How to do successful marketing and becoming an app millionaire will have to be investigated in another episode. The only thing left to do now is to prepare for success. Time to decide on your signature outfit. Just remember, grey t-shirts and black turtlenecks are already claimed. Since this is a Berg World podcast, I wouldn't like to end without telling a joke. So, on her way home, my sister, who is also adopted from South Korea, was once asked where she came from. Without thinking, she answered, "From the parking lot." Thank you for listening.
Okay, so that was Frida. Great talk from her, very much appreciated. Nice to get people from all around the world. It's amazing, isn't it? She's from Sweden, as I said in the introduction. So, yes, good. Now, her talk I found very interesting and very inspirational, and there were certain things with it that really resonated with me. One was this whole thing about doing your competitive analysis. I remember back in the day when we created our first app, called Get Sign Off, which, to be honest, was a train wreck from beginning to end. And one of the things that we got wrong was the competitive analysis. We did do it. We did take the time to look and see what competitors were out there, but we didn't do it very thoroughly. And as a result, we thought we had a niche all to ourselves when, in fact, we didn't. And it turned out that the other people that had approached the problem had approached it in a better way. Let's be honest about it, and had done a really great job at it. And it's so easy to skip over that kind of competitive analysis because we get so enthusiastic and so passionate about our project. We just want to get going with it. But it's so important that we do it, and we do it thoroughly. I also liked, obviously, her whole bit about focusing on the essential features, the idea of creating a minimal viable product. I think that applies pretty much whatever you're building, even if you're building a content-heavy website. Start with the minimal viable product and go from there. And that's something I've written a lot about. And I'm sure my gorgeous wife, who transcribes the show, will put a link in the show notes at this point to what I've written about minimal viable product. The other thing that I thought was very sensible in what she was saying was the whole thing about, as you're budgeting, both in terms of time and money for the project, how important it is to think about the promotion of your application. It's so easy to be so focused on building the thing that you forget the almost bigger job of, you know, promoting and managing that app over the long term. And there is significant time and monetary investment involved in promoting and making sure people hear about your product. Because it could be the best product in the world, but people won't use it if they've not heard of it. So the marketing and promotion of a product is absolutely essential. I also really liked her comments about designing for white men with higher than average wages and no accessibility issues. A little bit of a dig, but not an entirely unjustified one. The truth is that the vast majority of us that work in this industry do fall into that category for whatever reason. And the result of which is that we have a tendency to think everybody is very much like us and design for people like us. But really, that applies whoever you are. You know, whether you're a man or a woman, whether you're white or from some other ethnic background or whatever the case, we all have our inherent biases. We all have our way of looking at the world and seeing the world. And it's very easy to think everybody is like us. So as you design apps, you have to remember that that is not the case, that there is a wide spectrum of people. Also, we do tend to naturally have the tendency to socialize and hang out with people that are like us, that think like us, that if we're techie, we tend to hang out with techie people. So we get this very biased view of the world, this kind of bubble that we live in. So it's incredibly important that we break out of that bubble if we're going to build something like an app to understand different audiences. And that's why life experience is so important whenever you're designing anything, really. That and meeting with your users and finding out what they're really like. One of the things that I've found most enlightening of anything I've ever done is where I've actually gone and visited users in their home. Because if you bring them into a usability lab, yeah, you get a little glimpse at their life and you see a little bit about them. But going to their home, you really get to understand them, how they think, how they see the world, what their technical knowledge is, etc. So really make sure you do that. And also, I'd encourage you to socialize with people that are from a very different background. I go to the pub once a week with a guy who thinks what I do is ridiculous. He thinks I get paid money for doing nothing and just for talking. He works with cars, which is very tangible and very real. He doesn't like computers. And so he's a very enlightening voice. But I know lots of people like that. And I think that's very healthy. It's a healthy way to be. So thank you, Frieda, so much. I ought to say where you can find out more about Frieda. You can find out more about her at redonion.se. So make sure you check her out. Okay, next up, we talk about our sponsor, which is Teacup Analytics. Teacup Analytics, We've had them on the show before talking about their amazing analytics package and how they make it so simple for people to understand the kind of complexity of what lies behind Google Analytics and, you know, all that kind of really complicated stuff that does your head in. But actually, I don't want to talk about that today. Instead, what I want to talk about is a new product that they have that TCAP are making AdWords effortless. Because you know that running AdWords campaigns in Google AdWords can just turn into a giant headache. If you ever have tried doing it, you will know what I mean. There's keyword research to be done. You have to work out your campaign structures. You have to write your ad copy in a compelling way. Then you have to create landing pages that are relevant. Then you've got to manage all of your bids and you've got to optimize them. And it can take hours of time each month. Well, TCAP now offer a new tool which makes AdWords as effortless and easy and straightforward as the analytics stuff that they did. And I was very impressed when I saw it. So here's how it does it. Basically, TCAP starts by helping you find the right keywords, right? So it asks you to answer a few simple short questions, and then TCAP will create both the ad and relevant unique landing pages to go with that ad just based on some simple questions. Once the campaign is running, TCAP is then going to handle all the bid optimizations. It's going to deal with negative keywords. It's going to test your ad copy for you and everything else in between. It really is quite a remarkable piece of technology. So it's currently in beta, and they're looking for beta testers to share their ideas and needs. And obviously, they thought of you guys when they were last sponsoring the show. They got so much really good feedback from you because you're that kind of audience, aren't you, that they thought they would try it again. So TCAP is offering currently limited invitations to their tool. And you can sign up for early access at teacupanalytics.com/AdWords. And they would love to hear from you and you get involved in creating it. So if you have worked on AdWords campaigns for your clients and would like to simplify the whole process, or if you do it for yourself, then get in contact with them. They would love to hear from you. So next up, we have a talk from someone called Marcus Lil... No, I can't get the surname. A bit of a weird one, this one. I nearly didn't include it. It didn't feel like it was the kind of quality that we had on the show, but I thought you've got to give new voices a start. So Marcus Lillington is a young whippersnapper who started a digital agency called Headscape Limited, and he co-hosts something called the Bogue World Show, and in a former life used to be a pop star from a band called Breathe, or at least that's what he tells people. I imagine, you know, not very realistic, is it, that he actually was? But today he spends most of his time working with clients to improve their digital professional presences. So I will quickly play this one. Don't lower your expectations, but he's trying really hard. He's trying really hard to share what he's learned about limiting design iterations. So here you go. Here's Marcus.
Hello, this is Marcus, and I'm going to talk about design iterations and whether we should limit them or not. This talk came from a chat in the Bogue World Slack channel where they had a huge fear of doing work that's not being paid for, which obviously is kind of fair enough. Nobody wants to do that. We'd all go out of business. So the fact that I'm even talking about this suggests that there may be another way. But going back to this idea of limiting the number of iterations in a contract, I guess everybody knows where they are. Client and agency or freelancer knows exactly where they are. We're going to do 2 or 3 iterations and then we're done. But what actually happens when the iterations are used up, but the design isn't agreed upon? Everyone's happy, of course. Not, I would suggest. You would basically have to renegotiate your contract, make amendments, saying we're going to do another 2 iterations for X amount of money. And that has to go back and forth, which is wasting your time in the meantime while that's being agreed upon. And then what happens when you do those 2 extra iterations and the design still isn't agreed upon? Basically, I suggest that everybody's going to end up not very happy. As an aside, if you think that your new client will try to exploit you, in other words, that they're looking to get you to do more iterations of a design purely as some sort of financial win, then I would suggest that you shouldn't work with them in the first place. To put it a different way, any client who views you as their supplier slave, in inverted commas, rather than their equal design partner, will bring you pain and misery every time. I was talking about this in the office the other day before I put this talk together, and you know, everybody kind of said, yeah, well, sometimes, you know, you have to take the work on if you're in a difficult place and you have to put food on the table and all that kind of thing. And I disagree with that. I think that if you take on a job purely because, you know, it's going to provide you income, but in the end it will probably mean that you end up losing money, then you're going to end up being worse off and out of pocket further down the line. So you need to learn to walk away from clients who you think are going to exploit you. That was aside number one. Aside number two, this goes back to the days, basically from print design, where clients had an expectation that their designer would bring them usually three different design themes that they would deign to pick from. I'm going to have the number two design, and I want you to run with that one. And obviously designers got, you know, they got wise to that, and they would do three designs and ensure that only one of them was really appropriate, and nine times out of ten the client would pick that one. So it was, there was a bit of a game involved there. And we walked away from that many years ago because, as I was previously implying there, it puts all of the kind of power in the relationship on the client. It suggests that you are just delivering some kind of product that they'll pick from and then send you away again. There's no collaboration in that relationship. So again, if you're still working in that way of, right, we're going to do three home pages for you in different styles, and you can pick one, let us know which one that will be, and then we'll go away back to our design cave and continue to work on that particular style, then I suggest that that whole process is suggesting that you're going to have to iterate and iterate and iterate. Whereas if you go down a different route, which is what the kind of purpose of this talk is, where you're being more, you have more of a partnership with your client and you're working collaboratively together on it, then the chances of them thinking, oh, you got that wrong and therefore you need to go and do it again, are much lessened. So how do we do that? The real key is ensuring that your client has a major role in setting the design of whatever it is you're designing for them, so that they're bought in and they therefore don't get a kind of a surprise effectively when you present designs to them. Because that, just going back to my previous example of the designer going to their design cave, often designers like to work in that way, kind of like, yeah, give me a brief and I'll go away and hide and come back with wondrous stuff. And what happens with that is you might have had an hour-long meeting or maybe just working from a written brief and come back with all this kind of cool stuff, and it doesn't really fit what your client wants at all, and they'll therefore reject it and say, please can you go back and try again. And you go back to your design cave. You might have had a short conversation with them about why it was wrong, but equally you might not have done it. It might just be, we don't like it, so we don't like the blue. Can you make it not blue? So you go back to your design cave and you do something that's not blue, and so on and so forth. It's just not a great way of working. We have, over the years, found out that a very good way to kick off projects is to have really quite long and in-depth face-to-face workshops, really to give clients the opportunity, A, to get their say on how a design should work, but also to understand what we need from them to make a design work. It's kind of to say, look, this is your role in this process. And their role tends to be, we have this business or organisation or whatever. We have this audience. This audience wants this from us. The character of our organisation is this. And really get into the nitty-gritty about what this organisation does, what makes them tick, etc., etc., so that we can learn from that and produce designs that are representative of that. And the kind of initial workshop ideas that we do around look and feel design kind of really delve into that. One we do is the something called the reception area exercise, where we'll ask, we'll split people into teams at the workshops and say to them, right, we've got a whole bunch of questions. We give them a questionnaire where we're effectively asking them to design a reception area for their organisation, something that represents their organisation. And the point of it is that they're providing ideas about aesthetic things, but not focusing on buttons and navigation and web pages and the like. And you tend to get a lot of similar answers. We like it, clean and airy and lots of space and all that kind of thing. But you will get certain quirky things coming out of that process that we can grab hold of and take to the design. And we'll talk about that thing, that quirky thing that we've grabbed hold of. And we'll run with that particular thing as a theme. And it was that idea came from the client. So they're expecting to see something that fits with that. We also, we do a lot of mood boards. We'll take certain themes from a brand and we'll create different mood boards based on those different themes or words or phrases, that kind of thing. Strength or innovation or something like that. We'll create mood boards around those things. But another exercise that we like to do in these workshops is to get the client to create mood boards. We'll have done the reception area first, and we'll come up with a whole bunch of descriptive words around what that reception area looks like. But we can apply some of those things to a website design. So we've got all of those things up on the board that people can pull from, and we'll again divide them up into teams, and we'll normally have a kind of mentor, for want of a better word, from Headscape, who'll sit with each one of the groups and basically kind of pull all the ideas together. Where we'll look at different image styles, color palettes, fonts, textures, all of those kind of things, and just create mood boards with the client. Again, the purpose of this is they are pushing it. It's coming from them to start off with. And again, quite a lot of it might not be worth an awful lot to the final design, but there will be certain aspects of it that are really valuable that we can pull into our design. It's not just a designer going away to their design cave and coming up with something that they think looks great. They're really, really well informed, and they have collaborated properly with the client. And what all of this means, doing all this stuff together and ensuring that there isn't this ta-da moment that where we've been away doing our work, design work, and we come back and we go, here we are, we've done this wonderful work, and the client says, I didn't see it going that way. I'd like you to do another iteration of that. Working in that way means that we can say to our clients, we don't limit design iterations. We are happy to just work on the design until you're happy with it. And we can do that without the fear that we're going to be working for a year just trying to get a design right. So we tend to charge a similar amount. It's not always the same. We know that some design processes are likely to take longer than others, but generally speaking, we will charge X amount of money or time to work on a design process based on experience of doing it in the way we work for a long time now. And sometimes it'll take longer than that, and that's fine, because sometimes it'll take less time than that, and everything kind of evens itself out. And it means the bottom line of all of this is that we don't get the unhappy client. We don't have to go back to them and say, well, I know you're not happy with the design yet, but our contract with you says you're going to have to pay more if you want to do any more work. Now, it's just pain and misery for everyone all around if you do that. So we wanted to find a way of getting around that. And the key to it is ensuring that the client has a major role in the process of creating that design. And we've done that, and experience suggests that working in this way means that we can say to people, we don't have to limit design iterations, and we're happy and safe in doing that. So that's my talk for today. Thanks very much.
So there you go, that was Marcus's talk, and I have to confess it was quite good, wasn't it? Not bad for an amateur. It's I suppose Marcus has been doing this almost as long as I have now, so he knows his stuff, if for no other reason than he's gone from one mistake to another. No, it was brilliant talk, and I have to say I totally agree with it. He talks a lot of sense, doesn't he, about design iterations. I think very much this idea of design iterations, functional specifications, waterfall projects, all the rest of it, is very much a relic of a bygone era. It comes from the pre-digital world, and it's just not as relevant in the way that we work and the way that we operate and the way that we can evolve the stuff that we do over time. But I think there were more interesting points in there as well, which were very easy to skip over because of the kind of main theme of iterations. Things like we can't allow all of the power to sit with the client, that we've got to establish the working relationship as being a partnership between us and the client. I think that was a really great point that Marcus made, and I absolutely and utterly agree with it. I also agree that it's much better to walk away from unhealthy clients. He talked about that several times, and he's utterly spot on. And I know that's really hard to do when you know you're a bit desperate for work and you think, oh, I really ought to take this. But almost always those projects are doomed to failure. It's as if the client can smell your desperation, and we can't get into that kind of environment. Also, we would be better off spending the time that we would have spent working with those kind of unhealthy clients to actually focus on winning better clients. You know, if you fill your time working with crappy clients, then you're never going to attract better clients. You know, you're always going to attract more of the same. So you need to step back in your business, even if times are tight, and actually focus on winning the quality clients that you really need. The other thing that I took away from Marcus's talk, which I thought was really good, was this idea of always including the client in the design process. Actually get them actively involved. You know, we still, again, this is a kind of hangover from the past. We kind of hold them at arm's length. And that's why we have so many problems with design sign-off, because they've got no sense of ownership over that design. You know, they don't feel like it's their design. And so as a result, you know, they don't feel that any problem or compunction with picking it apart. But if they're involved in the process, if they help create the design, not only do they understand the design better, but they're also going to be much more likely to sign it off because they were involved in creating it. Not only that, they'll defend it to other people because it's as much their work as it is your work. So brilliant talk on design iterations, but please, please don't let Marcus hear me say that. All right, let's talk about our second sponsor of the day, which is Full Story. Full Story offers an amazing set of analytics tools that really just take analytics to a whole nother level. In my opinion, it's the best analytics tool out there for us as user experience designers. Full Story has loads of different features that I really love. One of them is called Page Insights, which gives you a toolkit to learn everything that you need to about how users are interacting with a specific page on your website. So for example, it's got a click map, right? So these are like the heat maps of the future, replacing that kind of splodgy confusion with real kind of clarity by showing where people actually clicked on your page, including when people rage click, you know, when they get really angry and just click again and again. Also, it'll show you errors and it'll show you dead links. So if you see something interesting on that page, you can add it to your search directly from the click map. So you can kind of drill in and get more details on that. Also, another thing that Page Insights functionality offers is an inspect mode. So you can watch a user interact with the page in real time and decide that you might want to know a little bit more about a button that they've clicked on or a text field that they've completed. So you can kind of inspect that and find out more details about what's going on behind the scenes there by adding it to search. So you can then see how many other people looked at that and all kinds of data. Anyway, don't listen to me waffle on about it. Go and try it for yourself. You can sign up today and get a whole month of their pro plan for free. You don't need to enter a credit card or anything like that. And you can still continue to use it after the month. It'll just limit the number of user sessions that you can have down to 1,000 per month, which is still pretty generous. You can get a good indication of what's going on your site without paying a penny. So definitely worth giving a go. You can find out more about them at fullstory.com. /BOAG, B-O-A-G. So we come to our last talk of the day, which is from Christina, who has 2 decades of experience in digital marketing, and also in dealing with a lot of the kind of legislation and limitations that are around that for both public and private sector organizations to ensure their online integrity. So she brings clarity to how organizations operate when they do digital marketing within a kind of regulatory environment, customizing policy frameworks that can give organizations a sense of security in how they deal with their digital marketing stuff, but also allow them to fully leverage digital in what they're trying to achieve. So she does some really interesting work, a little bit different from many of you and what many of you do. But I found her talk incredibly compelling and incredibly enlightening. So she's basically talking about the idea of digital integrity, the idea of ensuring that as we operate online, we do so safely from a legal standpoint, but also from a kind of best practice point of view. And she talks about clarity and control and values and those kinds of stuff. So it's a really, really good talk. I would encourage you to listen to it now.
Hi there. This is Christina Podnar. I know that managing digital marketing across the globe and in local markets can be a lot like parenting kids with ages ranging from toddler to teenager, maybe with a couple of dogs and cats thrown in for good measure. You're probably always multitasking. There's never a time to give anything your full attention, and some things linger at the bottom of the to-do list unless they become emergencies. But just as it's better to handle a cold before it turns into pneumonia, there are some aspects of running digital marketing that are much easier, if not much less expensive, to address before they turn into emergencies. If you're like me, the problem is that there's a big difference between realizing that and actually doing something about it. Awareness doesn't magically lead to additional funds or more free time. Sometimes, though, you just have to shove your urgent issues aside so that you can take care of the important issues. To assist you in addressing your important issues, I will share 3 ways to bring perspective to your organization's online efforts and the regulatory environments in which you operate. I will help you identify what you need to create a digital policy framework that will free your organization to fully leverage digital channels for marketing and communications purposes while minimizing the risk of lawsuits, regulatory fines, or embarrassing mistakes. The 3 specific things I'll talk to you about are clarity, freedom, and value. So clarity begins with the insight on your organization's potential problems. Looking across the global enterprise and through every aspect of the digital business, it extends to clear policies and actionable programs that chart the path forward for leadership. And it also helps the day-to-day digital workers understand what's in digital policies as well as what's behind them. As you work to bring clarity to your organization's digital opportunities and risks, consider your industry's regulatory and legal requirements, the size of your organization, and the geographical location where you operate. So let's look at each one of these in greater detail. First, be clear on the digital regulatory and legal requirements for your industry. For example, banking requirements differ significantly from those of life sciences, and personal products have yet different online constraints. You should become familiar with what you must and must not do in digital space as a result of your specific industry. Second, you should be clear on how the size of your organization impacts your responsibilities. For example, a product company that generates over $10 million in annual revenue from consumers in the United States and including California must comply with a supply chain regulation that certifies the products as being produced without the use of slave labor. A little known fact, but important, especially if you operate with California representation. And lastly, you should really clarify the geographical regions and country market locations that form your digital requirements. For example, if you're collecting data on customers in the European Union, China, and maybe Russia, you should be aware that their information cannot be transferred onto servers outside of the individual regions and countries. And that extends to cloud service hosting, which can get specifically challenging because the cloud is as much of a concept as it is a specific place. So to summarize, understanding what regulatory and legal requirements apply to your industry, what compliance requirements are applicable to your company based on its size, and what you must do for your geographical operating locations will help you gain clarity and get risky digital activity under control. The second concept I want to talk about is freedom. So freedom is really about policies, not so much being a set of restrictions, but a means of liberating your organization from uncertainty, from risk, and from internal chaos to take full advantage of digital opportunities. Digital policies that are built around your individual business, that are responsive to its unique priorities, and are flexible for its future, actually empower the enterprise. And they're frameworks for innovation, not obstacles to it. As we look at how to introduce freedom while also driving digital integrity, consider the following. Policies really create autonomy within a digital policies framework. They let the marketing team do their job while reassuring auditors and legal counsel that the organization is protected. And digital policies make the process of complying with key requirements easy and straightforward for digital workers. That's really, really important. So let's look at freedom concepts in greater detail. Freedom within a framework means knowing where the guardrails are, which allow really staff to create and innovate within the boundaries of acceptable online content, functional, and even marketing behavior. For example, if a policy defines the aspects of branding that must be consistent across all of your digital channels, such as the web, social media, mobile applications, portals, etc., things like logo, colors, and fonts, then you can really let marketers be creative in terms of what they're doing for layout, design, and how they present information while still promoting the organization's signature look and feel. Second point is that freedom to operate digital channels is really important while giving other folks like legal counsel, privacy and security officers, and definitely auditors comfort because you have key boundaries in place and they know that you're going to protect the organization from really scary scenarios. For example, if a privacy statement is automatically added to each page of your website via content management system, then auditors and your privacy officer can rest really at night knowing that the policy statement will always be there and that it'll read consistently. That doesn't always happen in organizations. If you do this, it will also help you in terms of updates on every page if a new requirement is required to the policy statement. So this allows your marketing team to really not worry about this type of an aspect or a requirement, and they shouldn't have to. They should worry about other things like the look and the feel and the messaging on individual web pages and websites. But again, it allows those people who are most concerned about risk to take it easy and to relax, and you can let business flourish as it needs to. And lastly, freedom for workers to do their job without tedious obstacles is a key goal of a digital policy framework. You should be thinking about things like short, clear, easy to locate and interpret statements, and make certain that they're enablers. For example, if you must comply with a number of country-specific regulations, it's easy for a digital marketer to leverage a checklist to identify those requirements and also to share them up front with a design or a branding agency. If you compare that to what many organizations do today, trust me, I've seen it, you provide pages upon pages of guidance that are probably full of legal and technical jargon and provide subjective information that needs interpretation. That's just wrong. It requires additional steps for a marketer and takes away from their focus. It's an additional burden. So if you think about it, you know, today, how we operate in the digital space, there are lots of risks. There's a lot of issues, possible gaps of security. The most safe and secure approach really is to not do anything in digital. Just don't do digital at all. But then consider again that it's the 21st century and that's no longer an option. We have to have a digital presence. We have to operate online. So instead of really aiming to provide digital that is constrictive and that is trying to protect the organization, you should really aim to provide digital with integrity by creating a framework within the freedom within the framework, and also ensuring that legal and regulatory risks are as much as possible minimized for the organization. Those who are accountable for those risks are reassured that you're actually managing your digital business properly and paying attention, and that you're also creating a mechanism that's easy to follow so that whoever's working in the digital space can really have the freedom to focus on their job and doing that job well. So far, I've talked about clarity and freedom. The last aspect I wanted to mention to you today is value. So value refers to ensuring your policies are usable. This is a little bit of a soapbox issue for me because a dusty set of prohibitions that employees ignore doesn't help you or anyone else in the enterprise. It neither does a PowerPoint full of platitudes or legalese that no one can translate to their day-to-day work. Value is really realized from digital policies that actually work for your business, and they pay off in digitally driven revenue. So how do you drive value through the creation and adoption of policies? First off, create value by making policies actionable, relevant, and easy to access. I've already referenced that, but if you take this following example, I'll illustrate it better. Don't publish your policies as PDFs and place them on random places on your intranet. I know we've all had that experience, right? Most employees waste hours upon hours searching an organization's intranet, which is where documents go to retire and die. I'm giggling, but it's true. Instead, you should create a repository for digital policies, or maybe even use an existing organizational policy repository you might have and extend it to house digital. That's also an option. In fact, organizations that get most adoption of policies, they tend to either extend an existing repository into a knowledge base, or they create wizards and checklists that make it easy for digital marketers to tailor those requirements that you have to their campaigns, to their projects, perhaps to vendor contracts, whatever it is. So when you make it easy to comply with policies, staff will more readily work within the required boundaries and follow them. The second point I have for you is that you should demonstrate the value of policies by incorporating them into existing tools and workflows. This might seem like a no-brainer, but a lot of teams today forget to do this. For example, many aspects of an accessibility policy can be embedded into a content management system. If you've ever thought about accessibility, how you have to actually tag images appropriately so that they can be read by an automated reader, you know that there are aspects that can actually be automated. There are other aspects, however, that require human interaction. And so you can divide those up. The systems enforced ones, like the requiring an image alt attribute to tag to be added to an image so that a reader can automatically identify for somebody who's visually impaired what the image is that's being displayed, that can be enforced via a content management system. And yet other things like ensuring that there's enough grayscale contrast for readability, or perhaps even some more advanced aspects of accessibility that need human interaction, those can be added as a step in the pre-production workflow process. So doing this ensures the organization meets its accessibility commitment, it's protected from lawsuits, especially those on the rise in the United States, and yet the burden on workers to continually be worrying about accessibility is really not emphasized in the creative or the publishing process. And in that way, you can demonstrate the value of policies by incorporating them into existing tools and processes. And last but not least, you should really communicate how policies add value, not create bureaucracy. I know that when I hear policies, sometimes I get excited. I have to admit, I'm a little bit of a policy geek, but it also makes me cringe a little bit because I know the reaction that most folks have to the word policies. But policies, if they're properly communicated and if there's a really good reason for them, not just to create bureaucracies, are helpful. For example, if you are a life sciences company that requires marketing materials to be approved by a medical signatory before release, basically an approver, policies can really add value by shortening the time it takes to gain that approval. Not only does that create value for the marketing team, but it also adds to the business's bottom line because you're shortening the life cycles, getting content out there faster, and you're also supporting the business value. So to summarize, value is created by making policies actionable, relevant, easy to access, incorporating them into existing tools and processes so they are not a separate activity and take an additional time, but they actually streamline the process. and then making the case and providing transparency into how the policies are helping make jobs easier and increasing the business's bottom line is really key. All right, so today we talked about clarity, freedom, and value. You can use these concepts to introduce digital integrity into your organization so that you can fully exploit digital while preventing unnecessary business and operational risk. And while I understand you're busy, I think we all are, and you probably have many urgent tasks on your plate, I hope that you'll take a bit of time away from the fire and focus on the important things. Otherwise, you may have unwanted emergencies on your hands, and I know that those are hard to deal with. So good luck. Take care.
So there you go. That is Christina's excellent talk. You can find out more about her by going to kpodnar.com. Now, I absolutely loved her talk. I thought it was really good. I know you might be wondering how the hell it applies to you in your situation, but the idea of having clear policies and procedures, I just think is so incredibly important when it comes to effectively running digital. And it's just a subject I spend a huge amount of my time talking about and writing about. Because it is so crucial. It's what will make an in-house digital team a success, or at least it's an enormous component of it, because it provides structure and all of these other things. But you might be working for an external agency, but even having structures in the way you operate and the way you work is really important, and it's something you should be talking to your clients about. So this is something, one of those things that really needs to move up people's agenda, in my opinion, of actually putting some kind of structure and governance. The trouble is that the web for so long was like Wild West, wasn't it? We kind of did things on the fly and by the seat of our pants, and we just kind of went for it. But that is not a healthy way to run what has become a business critical feature. So we really need to put the governance in place. Of course, doing that is not always easy. I mean, Christina said at one point, sometimes you need to shove the urgent issues aside and deal with the important issues. And that is exactly what governance is. It is one of those important issues that unfortunately gets pushed out too often because of the urgent ones. And so we need to make sure that we return to that and that we actually give it the kind of priority that it needs. Another point that I liked that Christina made, which was really good, was this idea that actually providing constraints, laying out the guidelines that people operate within, provides people with a freedom to know their boundaries. It makes people feel safe. For example, one of the big things that I often struggle with is getting people to contribute content within organizations, to write blog posts, to do social media updates and that kind of stuff. And oftentimes the root of that is fear that they're going to get in trouble if they say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing. They'd prefer to keep their heads down. So if you provide a set of constraints within which they can work, they know they're safe. They know they're in a place where they don't have to worry about all of that kind of stuff, which is so, so important. Really good. And then the final thing that I really like that Christina said is the idea of embedding policies into the tools that we use. So, for example, a CMS. So when you go into a CMS and you are going to edit a page or whatever, just to have some guidelines of what you should and shouldn't do. And I don't think that just actually applies to policies. I think it applies to training too. We send people on these like writing for the web training courses and things like that, or how to use social media. But then it goes in one ear and out the other. But if it's actually in the tool where they're creating the content, then it's much harder to miss. So some really solid advice for Christina. And I hope you found it as useful as I did. So that's pretty much it for this week. I'm going to share with you a Marcus type joke, which is, I had a dream I was swimming in a giant ocean of orange soda. It turned out to be a fantasy. Fantasy. See? See what I did there? Probably not. I don't know. Do you get Fanta in other countries? It's a type of orange soda. Yeah. Should have thought that through a little bit more. All right. Well, never mind. Right. Oh, it looks like I've just noticed that Andy has put in an Australian joke as well. But I won't say that. I'll let him keep that for next week when he does finally join us. If he manages to get the time zones right. But there you go. We are still looking for some talks, actually, for the show. So if you'd like to submit a talk, you can do so by going to boag.world/season18. I think we still need about 13 or 14 talks. So there's still ample space to get you in. So make sure you submit your talk. And if you're worried in any way about it, let me know and I'm happy to review it for you before it goes out. I won't let anything go out that's embarrassing except for Marcus's talk. Okay, so that's it for this week. Thank you very much for listening. I'm sorry you've only had to listen to me, but hopefully it's been an enjoyable show anyway. I've just certainly enjoyed being the only one that gets to talk. I really feel that is the way it should be. Other people should just listen to me. Yeah. Anyway, thank you.
Oh, my God.